And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Good morning. Here we are once again. It's Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO Community Radio Portland. I am the host, Paul Rowland. And, of course, that was David Bowie. You know that. I thought that was it's actually Jordan, one of my guest suggestions for a theme song this morning. It seems to go with the theme of the therapeutic use of psychedelics. And in the studio, I have Jordan Weiss, a newly appointed treasurer of the Portland Psychedelic Society, a field mycologist and educator. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Paul.
And I was going to ask you how to pronounce your name, but let me give it a shot, okay? It's okay. Actually doesn't probably not that difficult. Lydia Lutsishina.
That was pretty good.
Thank you. Who's an aspiring psychotherapist versed in the neuroscience of psychedelics. She wrote her thesis on psychedelic therapy, exactly the theme of the show, and currently volunteers with the Suicide Hotline and works with Decriminalized Nature Portland. I'm going to ask you about Decriminalized Nature, and I'm going to ask you a lot about the Portland Psychedelic Society as the hour goes on, Jordan, because the Portland Psychedelic Society is having its annual conference coming up later this month, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be on Saturday, October 25th at the Revolution Hall. It's the Ancient Wisdom for Modern Healing. And we'll talk about the presenters and some of the things that are going on and some of the work that's going on here in Portland around that.
Sounds great. I went to the conference last year, and I was really amazingly, I was impressed. I thought it was really well organized, and some of the talks were, I wasn't aware of how much psychedelic research has come back into a lot of institutions. So there's a lot of people, a guy from Johns Hopkins, a bunch of people who are really, really deep into it. Anyway, so it should be really good this year. At the beginning here, we're expecting a call from Danielle Grondin, who's the director of training with Folk Time, which is a mental health peer support nonprofit, which has a ongoing commitment to provide a culture of inclusiveness and promote a recovery-oriented support system. One of my co-hosts in training, Reggie Lee, actually also works with them. Anyway, she'll be doing a presentation this evening as part of the Rethinking Psychiatry's monthly event series. That's 7 p.m. this evening at Montville United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th in Portland. And while we're waiting for her to call in, let me just tell you a little more about the event this evening. I often have someone from Rethinking, one of their presenters or one of their people who work with that group, on the first Wednesday of the month because it coincides with their event. This time we're doing something a little different. Intentional Peer Support and Trauma with Danielle Grondin. Danielle will guide us through an interactive session on intentional peer support and how we can understand our experience of trauma with mindfulness and self-care. This session will be useful for working with our own experiences and for providing support to others when trauma is a part of our lives. Okay, and I'll tell you more about that if we don't hear from Danielle, but hopefully she'll be calling in within a few minutes. Okay. So while we're waiting for that, tell us a little bit about yourself, Lydia.
Sure. So I recently graduated, and after graduating, I started working with Decriminalized Nature Portland and, like you said, the Suicide Hotline, and I feel like I've definitely been given a platform to sort of work on the things that I think are really important. I think what I've found in a lot of the hotline calls that I've taken is that there's a lot of isolation in our society, and a lot of people are struggling to find community. And I think that that is honestly something that psychedelics and psychedelic therapy can help us build again. So that's kind of my passion, sort of the thing I've been working on.
Sounds good. And what is Decriminalized Nature Portland?
So Decriminalized Nature Portland, we're an organization working in a grassroots way to essentially make all plant medicines available for therapy in our city. And there are multiple bills going around. This is the city one, similar to those done in Oakland and Denver. And essentially, we run events, we raise funds. Right now, we've got a lawyer pretty much done with our bill, and we'll be able to start taking signatures soon for 2020 ballot.
Sounds good. And Jordan, talk a little bit about your experience. I know you're recently with the Portland Psychedelic Society, but you are a mushroom guy of long standing. I know that.
I know.
I know that there is a certain class of mushrooms that actually is psychedelic. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, I just a little background note. I did live with you, Paul, for a couple of months, and this is when your mom moved to town, and it was during mushroom season. So I had the great pleasure of being able to bring wild harvested mushrooms into your house that your mom remembers picking 30 or 40 years ago when she lived in the East Coast.
You know, actually, you know, this I should do this off the air, but what kind of mushroom was that you seeded in the backyard?
Oh, that is probably King Stravaria.
Okay. Anyway, continue, please.
Thanks. So the Portland Psychedelic Society is a volunteer-based resource organization for people who are interested in alternate modalities of healing using entheogens. And for people who don't know what entheogens are, they are a chemical substance that's typically of plant, mushroom, or more largely biological origin that is ingested to produce a non-ordinary state of consciousness for religious, spiritual, and something that's emerging most recently, healing purposes. So I was recently appointed treasurer, and I gave a couple of presentations on psilocybin mushrooms over the last 2 years, and it's another opportunity to engage in community-based group. That's something I really believe in, and that there's a super need for this kind of engagement here in Portland and the world in general.
Indeed, indeed, as we all know. Well, now we've heard a little bit from both of you. We do have Danielle Grandin on the phone. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No worries. So tell us a little bit about Folk Time and your work and the event this evening that you're going to be presenting at.
Sure. Yeah, so Folk Time is a peer-run organization, and peer in this context means everyone who works there identifies as having lived experience with either mental health challenges and or addiction challenges. And so I'm really honored to be part of their team. I'm the director of training there. And so I train a curriculum called Intentional Peer Support, which is also a curriculum born out of our movement, so the Consumer Survivor Ex-Patient Movement. And tonight I'm speaking with Rethinking Psychiatry, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Tell us a little more about this Intentional Peer Support, which is, and trauma, which is the theme of your talk tonight.
Yeah, so Intentional Peer Support is actually a framework developed by Sherry Mead out of the 70s and 80s, which was developed for an alternative approach to the way people were being treated in psychiatric systems in particular, and that's where it was born out of. So the alternative approach is really how to be with people differently. So what I will talk about tonight is the foundation, which is the principles and tasks. So it's a 40-hour curriculum that I teach every month, and tonight I'm really going to condense it into an introduction and then focus on, which might sound a little twisted, but my favorite topic, which is trauma, because I think when you start to get into our movement, you realize that what connects most of everyone who identifies as a survivor is that there's a commonality of trauma in some way, shape, or form. So I spend a good amount of time tonight talking about the module of trauma and how it can impact our relationship, but also really this reclamation of trauma and using it as a lens to learn more about ourselves and about our resiliency and really that strength that can be found in struggle.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything more you want to tell us about what's going on with Folk Time and your work and how people can support you all and plug in?
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, Folk Time is a pretty small nonprofit, and I think it's really important to the work we're doing around building awareness, reducing stigma, and we have a fundraiser coming up, which, you know, we don't have anyone on our team who's in charge of doing that. So it's everyone, like, all hands on deck trying to even just bring people together to support. So our fundraiser is on October 20th. It's a breakfast silent auction at Huber's. And then that would be great if people could attend, because we have to get tickets sold. But also, if people aren't able to make the breakfast, just going to folktime.org and donating or connecting to one of our programs and volunteering. We have social programs so people can show up and just connect with people who are there to socialize and be part of a community. We have all sorts of programs, so there's many ways to support beyond just monetarily.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that. I will put that additional information on my program page for Wednesday Talk Radio for this date. And again, you're speaking tonight, Wednesday, October 2, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Montevilla United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And I did neglect to say I had actually written a few lines, which I got cut off of this, what I copied off from the program page, about this show. Which is has been emerging as one of the regular co-hosted shows on a particular theme. I call it mental health, cognitive liberty, and neurodiversity, or something like that. Anyway, and also how to fight the system. So. Usually, as I said, we have someone from Rethinking Psychiatry. Today, we've got Jordan Weiss with the Portland Psychedelic Society and Lydia Lutsushina who works in the field of psychedelics and psychotherapy. And we're talking about healing and psychedelics today. And so we're going to open up the phones at any time you'd like. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Do you yourself, have you had experience with psychedelics and healing? Are you a healthcare professional? Are you someone who has had mental health issues that are interested in the subject and have questions to ask? You can call in 503-231-8187. And before we get started again with Jordan and Lydia, tonight there's another event, which is also a Portland Psychedelic Society affiliated event. It is actually called Healthcare Professionals and Psychedelics. And it is at Tabor Space, 7 to 9 p.m., and it's every first Wednesday of the month until November 5. I believe it is a open event. I'll just read a little bit. As the psychedelic renaissance grows and interest in microdosing continues, an increasing number of practitioners are seeing clients and patients who are working with psychedelics. There will also be an opportunity to network with your professional peers and discuss topics related to healthcare and the psychedelic sciences. So obviously it is oriented towards people working actively in that field. So Lydia, let's get into this.
Sure.
I did a little, I'm somewhat familiar with the history, but I did a little reading, and it seems like the first psychedelic research first psychedelic therapy mm-hmm. was in the early mid-50s.
Yeah, it did start in the 50s, for sure.
Tell us a little bit about the history and, you know, where some of the centers of research were and then how it all kind of mostly got shut down.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it started in the 50s, it definitely didn't have the kind of stigma that it carries now, where there's so many things that have to be approved in order for research to be done. It was much more of a substance used in more elite intellectual circles, and it had sort of come out of universities or out of people who were kind of in the higher class. For example, mushrooms were brought back to the U.S. from Mexico from one of the founders of J.P. Morgan, Chase Bank, and that was sort of when they became known in the public eye. There was a Life article published about magic mushrooms that give you visions, and that was when people learned of that. And
You said Life magazine?
Yeah, Life
magazine.
What year magazine. Was that? I think like 1952, 1954.
It was 1957.
1957, okay. Yeah. And so that was kind of when mushrooms hit the public awareness in the U.S. And after that, a lot of the research focused on dealing with alcoholism. So they would sort of take a lot of people struggling with alcohol addiction and give them a few sessions with mushrooms. And a lot of times they saw improvement, or they saw people be able to kick drinking, or they saw personality changes in people.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that actually the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous took a fair amount of LSD and was really committed to it. I think it's kind of been whitewashed, you know, washed from their books at this point, but anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people aren't aware that this is not a new field of research, that it has been, first of all, an ancient practice, and second of all, already had quite a lot of scientific evidence in the 50s. I think a lot of why people were skeptical about it had to do with the stigma in the 60s, and also had to do with more contemporary scientists feeling as though a lot of the research methods in the 50s were not controlled enough. But a lot more controlled experiments have been run and sort of replicated the same questions.
Well, you say 50s, but it really got going big time in the 60s.
Absolutely, until...
especially with LSD being brought first by the CIA. And
and that was something that was definitely rising and getting a lot of press. You know, people were feeling like it was a miracle drug. Therapists all over were sort of just like sending each other LSD, sending each other various substances, saying like, you gotta try this, like you gotta try this with your patients. There were like networks of people working with the drugs, and then a lot of people definitely blame Timothy Leary for the downfall of that heyday, because he kind of spread LSD to such a large amount of people at a very controversial political and social time. So, I mean, even there's a quote from the Nixon administration that said, you know, it was never about the drugs. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be anti-war, and we couldn't make it illegal to be black, but we could make the drugs they were doing illegal, and so that's what we did. And I think that's a lot of why LSD became so stigmatized, is because it was a part of this counterculture, and because a lot of those stories of like, oh, kids look into the sun and go blind, or like person feels like they turn into a glass of orange juice and fall over and think they died, and people jumping out of windows. And some of those things did happen, and some of those things did not happen. And some of those things happened when people were not only on psychedelics, but were also on a number of other drugs at the same time. And then those stories were so popularized that, you know, they became extremely like stigmatized. And at the same time, sometimes stories would come out later being like, oh, that story wasn't true. But the damage would already be done, because people would have already made that connotation and would have already read that story. So then slowly research started to shut down. I think by the early 70s, the last studies that were sanctioned were run, and then it kind of went underground after that until...
So what... I think they're somewhat fairly similar. I'm sure since there's been this, as they say, renaissance in the 2000s mm-hmm. of psychedelic research and therapy, But tell us about a little bit about the modality. I think it probably there's some similarities from the early studies to the ones now. How would a session go with someone being administered or being given a dose of psilocybin or LSD or MDMA in order to deal with whether it's PTSD or addiction or...
Absolutely. I think one of the best sort of case studies of this and a great book to read about this is called Acid Test by Tom Schroeder. But Michael and Annie Mithoffer are two psychologists that work with MDMA, and they've done a lot of the groundbreaking MDMA research with MAPS and Rick Doblin. And the way that they've done it is very similar to the ways that many people practice it. So first you have a debriefing session or several debriefing sessions without the drugs where you talk to the client, you talk to the person, you kind of learn about their history, you learn about their trauma, you learn about what they're going through, and you kind of talk about, you know, the drugs and, you know, why they feel like this is the right move for them. A lot of times people come into these studies because they find that nothing else has helped. They'll be like, I've tried antidepressants, I've tried therapy, I've tried this, I've tried that, nothing's working. Like, I want to be in this MDMA study because my PTSD is still really bad. And so a lot of times, those are the people that are coming. And then after a few debriefing sessions, then you go into the experimental session. And part of this is could be seen as slightly unethical because you could be giving someone medicine that could help them. But in order to do a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, some people are not actually receiving MDMA or LSD or mushrooms or whatever it may be.
Well, you can see that with a lot of medicines that don't necessarily have a psychoactive thing. But isn't that somewhat counterintuitive with these? Or?
Right. You know, you'd probably know whether you got MDMA right. or not, which is part of why a new practice is not either giving someone MDMA or a sugar pill, but sometimes they'll give someone MDMA versus Adderall. Or MDMA in a high dose versus MDMA in a low dose. Or MDMA in a high dose, MDMA in a low dose, and MDMA in a really low dose. And I think that's how the Mithoffers did it. They had the high dose sessions, they had the low dose sessions, and they had like very low dose sessions. And there's also a whole history of like different perspectives on whether high or low dose is more ideal for therapy. And so then after you sort of collect the data with the folks that had the high dose versus the low dose, and you see how they're improving on a number of surveys, self-reports, other kinds of things, you kind of like wait for several months and kind of record that person's progress following the dose. And you are obviously keeping up with them and continuing to practice therapy with them for several sessions following the dose. And then sometimes you don't talk to them for a while, and then you check in again in a year with their progress. In other studies, there might be like, okay, you take a dose every couple months. So it kind of depends, but it always is controlled in terms of, are you getting the high dose or a dose, or are you getting a low dose or no dose, and then making comparisons with like various surveys and various therapeutic sessions.
So cutting to the chase, as it were, so what had been the results back in the day, and what you did mention, you know, success in terms of dealing with alcoholism, and now it's obviously, since the research has come back, and it's probably the protocols might be being more refined, and there's there's a it seems to be expanding as the sort of this slow creep towards possible, well, opening up certainly therapeutically, if not, you know, whatever, recreationally, a lot of substances. What have been the what's the overall verdict on the results, kind of across the board, or are there some areas that it's more effective than others?
Across the board, the studies from, they've really been pouring in from like the last 6 years or so, and their results are overwhelmingly positive. I mean, there's studies such as mushrooms can help people overcome terminal cancer anxiety. Nobody in the study had a negative reaction to the substance, and so many people reported feeling connected through nature to each other, feeling like life didn't really end, feeling like they were able to come to peace with very huge questions that are otherwise going to be outside of our grasp. And they've also helped people with treatment-resistant depression. And mushrooms have even helped people that are not mentally ill, that are perfectly healthy, to experience mystical experience that they've rated among the top five most significant experiences in their lives, akin to the birth of a child or a death of a family member. And within these studies, they always screen first as well. That's a part of the process. You want to make sure people don't have a known family history of psychosis or schizophrenia, just to be safe, because there's some things suggest that it could lead to the onset of a disorder like that. Not that it would cause it if you don't already have
it. If you're predisposed,
but if you're already going to get it, it could speed you getting it. So they don't want to take those kind of risks.
They even say that about marijuana, actually, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes there's some screening for personality as well. There was a large meta-analysis by Busso et al. In 2018, I believe, which kind of just looked at all the personality tests run on people going into psychedelic studies, and it seemed that a lot of times you want to take people with higher openness and higher extroversion into these studies. That's using a test called the NEOPIR, which measures your personality on five scales. And essentially, a lot of people that benefit from or who take psychedelics are already predisposed to have a good time on psychedelics, in a sense. I think a lot of people in this movement worry, like, oh no, everyone's going to go take drugs and go crazy. And it's like, the people that want to take these drugs are usually already very open, sort of mystical people in the first place. And that already benefits their experience before they take it. And then a lot of times their traits in openness and extroversion increase after the experience. So in a way, the people that benefit from psychedelic therapy are already very self-selecting.
And I would like to add that for a long time, there was no academic studies on any of these substances. And then I think it started up in 2005 at the Johns Hopkins University with Dr. Roland Griffiths. I think they brought back some psilocybin testing.
Mm-hmm.
And the first reports were just, like you said, it's like people had these experiences that were unprecedented in any other field outside of the use of entheogens. It was comparable to the birth of a child or the death of a loved one. I did want to mention that there's a group called the Zendo Project, and it's a nonprofit psychedelic peer support program that provides emotional support services in a comfortable setting for individuals coping with the difficult mental and emotional effects that can arise from the use of psychedelic substances at festivals and events. They specialize in harm reduction.
Uh-huh.
So we actually...
Is that a national or a local? Or
I think this is a national
organization,
but we're actually reestablishing a new relationship with mental health, with healing, with medicine work. And
we as Portland Psychedelic Society.
I think just people in general who, like Lydia said, like people who use these substances who are already kind of open and kind of interested in the mystical aspects of them.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When marijuana was legalized in Portland, in Oregon, that you know, of course, I went out. I'm not actually a big smoker. I'm kind of like, I go through waves. Like every few months, I'll smoke for a while and then not. And anyway. I went and bought, you know, right the first day, of course. And then every time I was on the phone, I would just start talking about it, just because, you know,
right.
you never could. I don't know if people grow up now in the current thing don't remember that, don't know this, but anyway, talking about these things openly. I mean, how do you feel about talking about your experiences, say, like on the air?
Oh my God! Well. The Portland Psychedelic Society a couple of years ago asked me to do a presentation on mushrooms, and my first experience with hallucinogenic mushrooms was in 1983. I was 17 years old, and I had the good fortune of going to a party in the San Fernando Valley and finding somebody who had them who actually had psilocybin mushrooms. So I had my first trip then, and it opened my eyes. I mean, I saw things in a way I'd never seen. I'd always been interested in dreams and alternate states of consciousness, but this was a game changer for me. So I had a lot of these experiences for years, and just knowing that it was illegal, I wasn't interested in talking about them in public. And I went to the Telluride Mushroom Festival a couple of years ago in 2012, and I met some people who were working with John Hopkins with a research project, and I actually talked to one of them about participating in one of the studies, and they said, well, you know, if you have a family history of mental health, you know, you might not qualify. So I continued just to, you know, I didn't take part in the study, and I just continued to learn and do what I was doing. And after a while, I went to a Portland Psychedelic Society support group meeting in 2017, and there was a group of people, there was like 30 or 40 people sitting around, and they were sharing their experiences around the use of entheogens to heal debilitating health conditions. And I was like, okay, actually what I've known all along is actually now it's hitting a greater usage, it's hitting a greater purchase point in our culture. So by the time I got invited to present on psilocybin mushrooms, I was like, okay, I actually feel comfortable now about talking about my experiences in front of a larger group. And it was very well received, and it kind of put me on the path that I'm on now.
Now, I jokingly, with great respect, characterize you as a mushroom guy, because you know a lot about fungi. Anyway, so was your interest in mushrooms in general sparked by a psilocybin experience, or had you already been, or is that like kind of an irrelevant question?
No, initially I was 12, and I saw mushrooms growing in this field of grass that had been laid down in our condominium complex in 1977, and they were the big green staining parasols. So there was a big fairy ring. I was 12 years old.
That's pretty magical.
I rode my bike past it, and my bike actually just went there. And I got off my bike, and I was sitting in the grass just looking at them for hours. They were beautiful. It's like you look at the mushroom, and all the macroscopic identification characteristics are readily visible. There's like a big flaring ring on the stem. The cap has these scales, and you can see the pinkish greenish gills on the bottom, and it was in a big fairy ring. So I went to the library at that point, and the books in the library in Reseda, California, where they were 30 years old at that point, most of the best pictures were ripped out. But I did learn how to use dichotomous keys, so I was able to identify this mushroom as an inedible species. So I saw it, I didn't have any intention of eating it, but it was just something that was just totally new to me. So my relationship with mushrooms just started kind of observationally. And a couple of years later, I got a Paul Stamets book, I got the Psychedelics Encyclopedia, and like I said, I'd been interested in dreams and altered states of consciousness, and this kind of led me down a really fun, pleasurable rabbit hole.
Well, we're going to hold those thoughts. We're going to pick up on, you know, how your journey coincided with the Portland Psychedelic Society, and get more into what's going to be presented at the conference coming up at the end of October. But we've got two callers, so let's go to our first caller, which is Karen. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Paul. I just wanted to be sure that young listeners do not get the impression that this is just all a game. I understand that for the gentleman from the Psychedelic or Mushroom Society, that it was a wonderful experience. But for people who are fragile mentally or who may overdose, it's not a game. I'm 73, and when I was young, I did know somebody who went through a plate glass window. And I'm personally really sensitive to those substances. I can't take them. So they cause paranoia for me. So it's not that they're bad. It's just that we have to be very careful about not harming anybody. So that's why I'm calling in, not to ruin your fun or not to be a Debbie Downer, but just because to be responsible. That's all. Thank you so much, Paul.
Okay.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
this is the so it does appear to be fun on the surface. A lot of people come to the usage of ethnogens through recreational usage, and there's a level, there's three different levels that people actually come to this. Some people come to these through recreational usage. Some people come to these usage of ethnogens through traditional usages. And now there's a movement for clinical usages. And they all have their place in the culture with humans. It's like, we're not going to stop doing these things. We're not going to stop changing our consciousness. When little kids are young, they spin around in a circle. I did that for a long time. I loved the feeling of spinning around in a circle on the grass and then falling down and just having a little altered state of consciousness. The thing that's very important is that in the right context, these entheogenic substances can do things. They can produce a healing effect that is we're hard pressed to actually find this anywhere else in our culture. Mm-hmm. And actually, the last thing that the two of us and many other people that we work with in town, we're not interested in making these available as another play toy. We don't want these available at every corner. You know, this is something that has the potential to do large amounts of healing, and like anything else, like alcohol, like Twinkies, you know, like vegan food, like kale chips, it can be abused, it can be used the wrong way. So we figure with a little bit of appropriate context, mm-hmm. and with using these through the lens of harm reduction, these do have a place in our culture, and they're very powerful healing modalities. And mm-hmm. in my opinion, it's about time that that they've been taken seriously.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, just thinking about the fact that there's a lot of miseducation and just lack of information, and I think that is where a lot of the problems can arise, because these are just so misunderstood and not used properly a lot of the time, like you're saying. But how is someone supposed to know how to engineer a healing set and setting if they don't even know what set and setting is, which means like the positive state of mind and like a conducive environment to a positive trip? And on top of that, if we don't have education about certain personality characteristics that could potentially mix worse with psychedelics, or about family histories of mental illness that could potentially lead to a bad trip, I think people don't have enough information. And while it remains a Schedule I drug, I think, like you're saying before, it was something that's kind of scary to just talk about in the open. Mm-hmm. And I think the less we fear it, and the more we know about it, and the more we're educated about it, the more people can make informed choices for themselves about using something like this.
Well, yeah, my response was, I mean, I certainly don't think we were treating it as a game. I thought we were taking it, you know, very seriously and exploring a lot of aspects of it. But in terms of, you know, one thing I wanted to talk to you all about is the, you know, we have these as Schedule I substances, yet the pharmaceutical industry produces massive amounts of psychotropic drugs, which, according to what I've been reading, are actually cause damage to the brain. You know, the positive effects that people feel, which I don't deny, are not because they're actually addressing, you know, the whatever the so-called mental illness, the root cause of it. No, it's because they're like suppressing some form of brain activity which is going out of control. But the collateral damage, the side effects are really dramatic. They accumulate in people, yet and people are sometimes involuntarily giving these substances, so the damage being done by those substances is apparently massive, yet they're being prescribed on a routine basis. So, I mean, I think we have to look at the overall picture. So, anyway, I want to go back to that subject, and again, you know, since we only have about 15-20 minutes left, talk about what's coming up at the PPS, Portland Psychedelic Society, conference. But we do have Harry on the line. Go ahead, Harry. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. The questions I have is, what is the dosage of using, like, mushrooms or any other ones, and how long is the effect? the trip.
Excuse me.
What do you want to call it?
No, that's a good question, Harry. Thank you for saying that on there. Ayelet Waldman came out with a book a few years ago called Microdosing, How to Have a Really Good Day. And that made it, that brought the concept of taking a small dose of entheogenic substances to the widest audience probably that it's had at this point. And what
it
does...
A
small dose can vary.
It could be like a mushroom cap, a small one. It could be like if you cut a tab of LSD into like six pieces and take 1/6 of it.
Yeah. So what you're going to get from this small dose is you're not going to really get a quote high, but you're going to have an opening in your body and in your physical senses that it's really hard to replicate otherwise. And in the right set and setting, this can be extremely powerful. It can be very healing. It gives a chance for people to actually talk about and feel things that they weren't ordinarily able to do. You know, our culture is kind of tough on people who like to feel things. You know, we have to work.
You wouldn't drive a car or operate machinery, correct?
Ideally, no. You would do this in a...
And what about the price? How much is a mushroom?
We're already verging into territory that's somewhat delicate, but I think we can't go there. Thank you, though.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Harry.
Okay, goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, these are all very, you know, we can't, you know, even admitting, you know, that you take these substances, you have taken them in the past.
It's a bit of a disclosure, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we do live in a surveillance society. Well, you know, especially if you're working in certain fields, you know, that you don't want a lot of attention brought to you. So, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a risk. And so, you know, there's a certain aura that, well, just in following certain conversations, when I joined the Portland Psychedelic Society Facebook group or whatever, it was just interesting. People would, occasionally see a question pop up. Well, you know, where can I get these? Like, people was like, wait a second, you know.
We're not a procurement organization.
I get that when I'm canvassing. People will be like, do you got free samples? Can I have a phone number? I'm like, I'm at work.
It's like, why don't you come to a meeting?
Anyway, we have 15 minutes left and you have that much time, maybe 10 minutes to get your question or comment or your personal story in at 503-231-8187. I really thought we'd have a whole lot of callers for this subject, but... a lot of people wait till the very end. So yeah, this the Portland Psychedelic Society's conference, what's going to be happening and where is it going to be again and when?
So this is the second annual conference. This one's called Ancient Wisdom for Modern Healing. It's going to be Saturday, October 26th at the Revolution Hall. And we have speakers that have been doing research, various aspects of research in this field for many, many years. We have Kalindi Lai, we have Anthony Bossis, Angela Ward. There's going to be a poster session. Fred Sly's PhD with healing music and 60s in set and setting. April Boulding, psychedelics and birth. Meryl Ward is going to be speaking about entheogens, the science of spirituality. We have a panel. Rachel Harris, a PhD, listening to ayahuasca. And James Fadiman is our keynote speaker. And he's going to be talking about microdosing and what we've learned and why it matters. So we're bringing this, quote, revived interest in entheogens to a wider audience through our conference. And the people that come here, they're genuinely interested in how to do things differently around their mental health. I mean, I know a lot of people who have had antidepressants. Myself, I had antidepressants for a couple of years, and the effect wasn't good. I wasn't able to access the healing that I needed. And like I said, when I had mushrooms for the first time in 1983, it was strictly recreational. I didn't even know the potential, but I knew that there was something there. My experiences in the last month have produced more healing than I've had in the previous four decades. And I can't speak highly enough about this as a potential to as a healing agent that can do things in a shorter amount of time in the right context with set and setting and with the right traditions. It's a very important part of my life, and I'm very grateful and I'm very humbled to be able to be here and to speak about this.
I want to, we got a couple callers I want to get to. I want to kick back to you after the callers, Lydia, mm-hmm. about who actually qualify for these studies, I think is an important thing. And sure. You know, maybe some of the people in Portland who are doing the research, the therapeutic, it's kind of research / therapy at this point, mostly,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. The only, you know, therapy that's being done is therapy that's being done in research studies legally.
And the other question is, if we have time to get at this question of like, is there like a contrast between the all the antidepressants, anti-bipolar, mm-hmm. Antipsychotics, all that what are called psychotropic drugs, mm-hmm. Produced by the pharmaceutical industry. Is there possible replacement value for some of these drugs? For, you know, we have anecdotal experience. Jordan just talked about it, and I've heard other people. But so think about that. Sure. But we do have Scott on line one. Go ahead, you're on the air, Scott.
Good morning, people. I appreciate your conversation this morning. There was an author I heard on a podcast. I can't remember his name. He just recently wrote a book. He's just a journalist.
Michael Pollan.
Yeah. And he had talked about the ego, and it was really fascinating how he was talking about how people can get in, use the ego in two different ways. You can use it as a defense mechanism and also to kind of get it out of the way so you can process some of the healing that you guys kind of alluded to. But I just curious, mm-hmm. if you're... guest would have anything about that they could share with us this morning, or me?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for asking that, Scott. The ego, pretty much, it's this part of our brain that made it possible for us to get here at this point. So we're actually not going to be losing it. But luckily, we have ways to mitigate the damaging effects of an ego. Anybody who's been around an ego-driven person, and I've certainly had my issues around this in my life, it's toxic. It's the ego is a source of a lot of toxicity. Through the usage, through the responsible usage of entheogens, the ego is actually taken out of the picture, almost benched, if you will, and the real person, the person underneath, can be accessed when we have entheogenic substances in the right set and setting and our ego is not in the way. There's an amazing amount of healing that happens. There's things that we get to talk about. There's experiences and emotions we get to have that in our culture are not widely accepted. It's possible for men to actually cry and even sob in the right set and setting with these substances. And even to that point, there's other ways of doing this too. People are going to use meditation. People are going to use peer counseling. There's going to be all these other modalities of healing that people can use in conjunction with this that will promote a kind of healing that has just not been currently available in any culture around the world.
Yeah.
And that's really what's kind of illuminating me, like a revelation lately about that whole topic of the ego. And he also mentioned that a guide is just really, really important to have somebody there to kind of facilitate this journey that you go on. Is that a good context that everybody's agreed on in this medical field or in this field you guys are in?
I think a lot of times, especially when you're starting out, it can be really helpful to have a therapist that's very validating and very open, or to have, someone that is a close friend with you. I think as people sometimes become more experienced, they're able to do it and guide themselves. But I would definitely say that in a first experience, it would be really important to have that guide. And going back to the ego thing, neurologically, your ego is literally dying because the brain center, known as the default mode network, which is a densely connected population of neurons, which usually takes a disproportionate amount of our brain's energy, actually reduces in how much blood flow it receives drastically. And parts of the brain that don't usually communicate begin to speak with each other while there's not any resources being given to the dense population of neurons that is ourself.
That's under the influence of these substances.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's good. Keep going.
No, we got to go to another caller unless you have a last quick question or comment, Scott.
No. I mean, I really appreciate you guys and what you've done and that you're local, and have a good day. And thanks again for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Go ahead before we go to Eddie. Go ahead.
So really quickly, if we use these substances without a facilitator, and that could be a clinician, or it can be an indigenous person who's worked with the medicine in their cultural context. Thank you. Cultural context. Without that, it's a recreational experience, and we're limited to the amount of openness and actual, I call them keys, that we can get. And when we use them with a facilitator or in the right set and setting, when you pay attention to these things, it sets the literal stage for different things to happen, for different parts of ourselves to become open once our ego is out of the way.
Let's go to our last caller. He's going to have to be our last caller. Eddie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, appreciate it. Thank you for having me on and covering this topic. I just wanted a quick confirmation or acknowledgement that what you're talking about is absolutely, you know, right and guided and facilitated support. I'm a veteran, Desert Storm. Previous to that, came back from the military, had, you know, some trauma issues from childhood. And when I, you know, recreationally entered the scene in the Bay Area with mycelia and mushrooms and the process, I can say that it was transformative. As an African American, it helped me process a lot of trauma. It helped me process military experiences. It made me face myself. And under supervised circumstances and in combination with therapy, I firmly support everything you're saying. And though it doesn't work for everybody, it does work for a lot of us. And microdosing is a management tool. It's better than citalopram. It's better than pharmaceuticals. And, you know, again, you know, I support this work. And as a farmer as well, mycelia and mushrooms talk to each other in the soil, and they're a critical part to our ecology, and both internally in our bodies and in the environment. And thank you again.
Thank you, Jordan. Jordan gave us thumbs up on that last subject. Thank you so much, Eddie. So we got to get out here soon. So, you know, people can read the new Michael Pollan book. What's the name of the book again?
How to Change Your Mind.
There's lots of resources out there. There's organization MAPS, M-A-P-S, which stands for something, but...
Multidisciplinary Advancement of Psychedelic Studies.
It's long time forerunner in this field. And Portland Psychedelic Society, again, there's lots of books, lots of stuff online. But, you know, if people really did are at a place where they're feeling like they're stuck, where they're, you know, severe depression or whatever, and they're interested in looking, how do people go about trying to join one of these studies or look for the resources that they might need?
Absolutely. I think a lot of recruitment is done at the three major centers right now that do this research, which are John Hopkins University, which actually just received a $17 million endowment for a center for psychedelic research. NYU does a fair amount of research, and Imperial College London also does a lot. I think that
there are small centers that are doing it too.
I think in Portland there's some place called the Somatic Center that I've heard of. And I think there might even be some studies at OHSU, but I'm not sure if like how far along those are. I think the best way would probably be to find out who's doing these studies and email them directly. A lot of times professors, researchers are actually quite open to receiving emails. I think usually recruitments can also be found by like Googling like psychedelic studies that I can enroll in or something like that. They'll probably want to screen you. You'll definitely have to be at least 18. And the screenings will probably have to do with extensive medical and family history. We'll have to do probably with some kind of personality screening as well, and probably interviews on top of that.
And of course, there's a burgeoning movement towards, you know, reclassifying some of these substances, making them, and they are being made more available. So you can join that. But go to this conference. It's a good way to hook up. Again, Saturday, October 26th at Revolution Hall here in Portland, the Portland Psychedelic Conference 2019, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Healing. Looks to be really good. Or they've got, as I said, lots of different events. There's one tonight, Healthcare Professionals and Psychedelics. That's at Tabor Space, 7 p.m. this evening. That's a 5441 Southeast Belmont. And once again, the Rethinking Psychiatry event, where you can hear Danielle Grandin, who was on the air here at the beginning of the hour. That's at Montevilla United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue, again at 7 p.m. Lots going on. We got to get out of here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, once again, visit us at the PortlandPsychedelicSociety.org. And thank you, Lydia, and thank you, Paul, for having us on. This has been a really good way to spend the morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And this is Paul Rowan with Wednesday Talk Radio. Be with you again next week, wherein I have Jacqueline Keeler as my co-host for the second Wednesday. All right.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse